Adolescents who drink alcohol before age 14 are significantly more likely to experience alcohol dependence at some point in their lives than those who drink after 21, which is the legal age of drinking in America. In addition, youth who drink alcohol are more likely to experience negative consequences, like physical or sexual assault, accidents, memory issues, getting on the wrong side of the law, and not doing well in school. But how can we prevent youth from getting into drugs, alcohol, and smoking when it's everywhere? Stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. When it comes to preventing substance abuse, there are risk factors on one hand and protective factors on the other. Some risk factors include a chaotic home environment with ineffective parenting, little mutual attachment and nurturing, and poor social coping skills. A basic rule of thumb, though, is to keep drugs out of the house and for adults in the home not to use them. Juan didn't have that privilege. Here's his story.
The farthest back that I can remember was probably about 2-3 years old, where I remember my father kicking in doors and putting hands on my mom and just beating her. I remember the cops coming over and the cops knowing us by name, bringing us toys, try to cheer us up. It was like a normal thing for them to come out. As my mom tried to leave that abusive relationship, she would go from one bad relationship to another, and it did introduce us to the drug life. I remember being 3-4 years old and sitting at the kitchen table with men just weighing out heroin, like if they were weighing out wheat or something, you know. I remember our houses being raided and us having to run to our neighbor's house so, you know, we wouldn't get taken. Of course, I didn't know why we were running. I just knew we were going somewhere, you know. I was just confused. I wouldn't know what was going on. I didn't even think anything was wrong. I figured, okay, that's life, you know, as any other kid would. I didn't put two and two together until I was about 9 years old, when my mother would send me upstairs to the apartments that we would stay at with an envelope. And my mother's boyfriend at the time was a manager, so I thought, hey, you know, I'm just collecting rent for her, because that's what she would tell me. And little did I know that she was sending me on drug deals, and I didn't even know. I was just 9 years old, 8-9 years old. Until one day my friend and I were curious. My mother ended up leaving, and my friend and I were curious. I wonder what's in this envelope, and I said, let's open it. So when we opened it, it's when I seen a bag of methamphetamines, and I just felt a whole bunch of different rushes and memories and visions in my head, just, you know, of everything else that I've experienced. And that's when I realized, you know, the kind of life that we've been living. And because I always thought, you know, hey, we live a pretty nice life, you know, we're doing pretty good. But, you know, it was, to me, it seemed like it's just been one big lie. After that, I just ran with it. There was no turning back after that. You know, I that's the kind of life we were living. So I figured, hey, that's going to be me. I was already selling drugs by the time I was in sixth grade. I was already a full-blown pothead. Going to school high, having weed in my pockets. I was a very sad child. I was very sad, I was very mad, I was very lost. I ended up becoming a cutter. I would cut my arms, I would burn my arms with the joints that I would smoke or cigarettes. Pain was something that I felt was my getaway to the pain that I already felt. Or, you know, just escaping from what was already inside, you know, that darkness, the emptiness. And it had a lot to do with the anger that I felt inside because of, you know, the lifestyle that was just around me. You know, my mother exposing us to that, and I'm thinking that she's the one that's supposed to take care of us, but yet she got us in the mix of everything, you know. Anger towards the world because of the things that were said by the people that I thought were supposed to care about you. You know, my mom, you're going to be just like your dad, or you're going to be just like your brother, or my brother calling me a punk, or, you know, saying that you know, I'm not good enough or whatever. And the teachers as well, you know, all this negativity that we hear saying that we're going to amount to nothing, that I'm just going to be in prison or dead or in jail or, you know, I'm not going to make it. So I figured, hey, if I'm not going to make it, I might as well make something out of it now. And I think that if somebody would have took action, you know, if paid attention to the red flags, you know, it would have been a whole different story.
But nobody did, although today's guest could definitely have taken action. She's a social worker, a psychotherapist, and the mother of three teen boys. Sean's here to get us up and about, and we'll add to the dish we've been making in the kitchen yesterday. But first, the news. In the headlines today, sleep deficit tied to binging, caffeine impairs fertility treatment, and ways to reduce cannabis use. Each extra hour of sleep a teen gets corresponds with a 10% decrease in binge drinking. These findings are based on data from 6,500 adolescents tracked since the mid-1990s as part of the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health. 45% of adolescents polled don't get the recommended 8 to 10 hours of sleep, and those with insufficient sleep are also more likely to have interpersonal issues related to alcohol. They're also more likely to drive drunk as college students and to use marijuana. So parents, help your kids to get enough sleep. That way you're helping them make good choices. A man's addiction to coffee could limit the success of a couple's fertility treatment, according to a small Boston study involving 105 men. Only 20% of couples in which the man consumed three or more cups of coffee a day were likely to end up with a live birth, compared with 55% of couples where the man consumed less than a cup of coffee a day. Now, while these are very preliminary findings, men, you might consider dropping the coffee for a while. Researchers in Canada report success in preventing, reducing, or delaying cannabis use amongst at-risk teens. Over 1,000 teens across 21 London high schools were identified to be at high risk for substance abuse. Risk factors included anxiety, negative thinking, impulsivity, and sensation seeking. The students took part in two 90-minute cognitive behavioural therapy sessions that involved real-life scenarios described by peers. Sessions were adapted to match their personality type. Although 25% went on to use cannabis during the next 2 years, there was a 33% reduction in the first 6 months. Sensation seekers were at highest risk, yet showed a 75% reduction in the first 6 months. So how about some cognitive problem solving with the teens in your life? I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. Today's interview comes from San Antonio, Texas, where we met with Alina Baltazar, Director of the Center for Prevention Education at the Institute for the Prevention of Addiction at Andrews University in Michigan. Like Juan's mother, we think we can hide stuff from our kids. I asked Alina how long before kids start noticing substances like nicotine and alcohol.
Actually, when they're very young. In fact, we encourage parents to start talking about it as soon as they can even understand and communicate. Because kids notice things. They notice when cigarettes are being put to the mouth or when people are acting funny. So we really encourage parents to start making those comments like, hey, you know, yes, they do that and we don't do that and this is why it's not good, to make it developmentally appropriate throughout their children's lives. But especially it's important during those middle school years. You really want to make it very clear where you stand as a family and according to your culture and religious traditions as to what you expect of your children.
We talk about gateway drugs, you know, the first one that sort of opens the door to it all. What's the most common gateway drug?
The most common is alcohol. Because that's what's in the home, that's what parents may be using themselves, and even some parents want to encourage their kids to drink at home because they're thinking, well, if they do it at home and I'm supervising, it's better for me to know what's going on as opposed to what's going on with their peers. Mm. But research has found that's actually putting their kids at risk because the kid is getting the impression like, oh, my parents think it's okay, so if it's okay at home, then it's okay with my friends. So that's
right,
because alcohol is more of that gateway drug.
Yes, I'm surprised some parents want to demystify alcohol, mm-hmm. and actually give their kids alcohol to drink
from
quite a young age. Does that put them at more risk of later becoming alcohol overusers?
Right, actually, because if you start young, and especially if it then turns out to be a regular use, then it's almost nearly impossible for them to actually get treated and recover from any alcoholism that may develop, because the younger they start, the harder it is for them to quit, and then they're actually developmentally arrested. So in other words, if they start using alcohol regularly at the age of 14, then it's almost like they've never really developed beyond the age of 14. Mm. So I've seen that over and over in my clinical practice as well. So you definitely want to be very careful.
It's partly that forming brain is at risk, more at risk than what an adult brain would
be. And marijuana use also, if it starts younger, it's more of a risk factor to cause permanent damage to the brain if they start regularly using. So a lot of people say marijuana is also a gateway drug. Alcohol more so, but marijuana is also a concern as well, especially when they start younger.
Right, and I think now with legalizing marijuana or the medical use of marijuana, there's potential for a switch.
Right, because there is now this thinking, oh, it's not dangerous, it's good for people who are sick, though marijuana use has actually gone down a little bit in the U.S. So the edibles especially can make people quite sick, and so maybe they are getting that message, okay, maybe it's not good for everyone, or there are people getting sick from it. So there is the message getting out there. It's not this healthy thing.
It's really sad that people have to die in order for the dangers of marijuana to become apparent, but at least a few are heeding the message. On the other side of the break, you'll find Phil in the kitchen, but first this.
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm mulching these vegetables. They're organic, you know.
Oh, that's a really good idea, because all the vegetables in the market are full of pesticides, aren't they?
So is that fish you're eating.
What?
Yeah.
No way. We all know that the biggest concern with pesticides is with vegetables and fruits, not with fish.
Oh, really? You've never heard of biomagnification?
Biomagnificent?
Biomagnification. You know, the big fish eat lots of little fish, which eat tons of phytoplankton plants living in pesticide-contaminated waters. And so as you go up the food chain, the concentration of pesticide gets magnified up to 10,000 times.
Oh, and I'm eating it?
Uh-huh. Happens with most meat.
Oh, no. So this is a chemical warehouse?
That's right.
So I should have ordered that phytoplankton burger instead.
Go vegetarian. Reduce your pesticides, herbicides, toxic chemicals, and your heavy metals. Doctor's orders.
Welcome back. We're in the kitchen again, and it's time to do the next stage of our recipe, which is the filling. Tell us, Phil, what's in it?
Well, this is our roasted veggie filling. So this is where the color's coming. It's so full of nutrients, and it's got great flavor.
Mmm. So what's in it?
Well, we're going to start off with two small golden or green zucchini, half a large yellow onion, a medium red or yellow bell pepper, two medium Japanese eggplants, a fennel bulb, 4.5 teaspoons of olive oil, 1.5 teaspoons of minced garlic, a teaspoon of fresh thyme, and a teaspoon of fresh oregano. You've got all kinds of things that are just going to culminate and come to these great flavors.
Wonderful. Well, we look like we were making a half a recipe here, so...
We are. This is going to be a little bit smaller. I'm going to start you dicing.
Okay.
And this is Japanese eggplant, just to share. The great thing about this is that it has no or few seeds. And it has a thinner skin, so be careful what you say about it. You don't want to offend it.
Okay,
since it doesn't have
thinner
a thick skin.
Right.
but it is great because it's not as chewy. And I'm going to cut up our fennel here.
Yes, yeah, sometimes those large eggplant can be a little bit bitter, can't they?
Absolutely. And I've had that before where I've made a recipe, and the large eggplant just was very chewy, and it just kind of took away from the whole experience of eating. This makes it a little bit easier to chew up. Now, when you
I'm glad you didn't give me that job.
This one's a little bit tough.
More creative than this.
This one with the fennel, you want to cut off the stems and you want to cut off the bottom. It's got a core in there that you want to avoid, which is a little bit tough.
Right.
But you don't want to throw away the leaves and the stems. That's all edible. You can use it in different recipes.
Actually, I bet that would make nice soup.
like just like you put celery, because fennel's related to celery, right? I mean, we often use celery in our soups.
Oh, absolutely. So you can see the core in there. You want to take off some of the outer leaves, and then that makes it a little bit easier for you to cut it up and dice it. You can smell it already.
Oh, yes. It smells wonderful. Just always looks good, smells great when roasting veggies.
Absolutely.
When you put herbs in, it just finishes it off beautifully, doesn't it?
And it has a consistency that I love. You've got, I mean, sometimes they're a little bit too strong, a little bit too crisp or something like that. Mm. When you roast them, you get all the flavors to come together, you get a great consistency, and it goes perfect with this.
Sure. Oops, does.
That one got away.
The fennel that flew.
So we've got our fennel, we've got our golden squash, we've got our green zucchini, and we've got our onions.
And I see you chose 3 different colors of sweet bell pepper just to make it really lively.
And that's the great thing. You can get all kinds of color, great nutrients from those.
Oh, wonderful vitamin C. And by baking, you lose less of the vitamin C. So, baking or roasting. So
I'm going to mix this up. I'll let you pour the oil.
I can smell that garlic, too. Ooh, okay.
And then I can get my hands dirty.
Sounds good to me.
You just want to put a little bit of this in there. You know, it's really just kind of to coat it and kind of protect it.
Stop it sticking. Yeah.
Correct. It'll stop sticking. It'll keep it from burning a little bit. They are just flying all over.
Yeah, they are. And I guess you could, if you didn't want to use the oil, which I tend not to use, you can use baking paper.
Yes.
And parchment. So you could use a little less oil. Wow, that looks so pretty. Look at it.
Yeah, it's got great colors, great taste. You just spread it out, put your oven to 400, and then you want to bake it for 20 minutes. And
do you need to flip it?
Absolutely. Halfway through, about 10 minutes, you want to flip it around just so it doesn't burn.
Great. Oh, I'm looking forward to tomorrow. Thanks, Phil.
Sure.
Mm-mm. There's nothing like the smell of roasting veggies on a cold night. In the first segment, we met Juan, whose earliest memories were of Dad beating up Mum. As a boy, his mum often sent him on errands, delivering envelopes that he thought contained rent money, until one day he looked inside and found drugs. His world fell apart. Instead of protecting him, his mother had exploited him, and he became an angry young man. Here's the next chapter of his story.
As a young adult, when my wife and I got together, we met in a drug deal. You know, she came over to my house and with a friend of mine. They just came to pick up and score, and they introduced her to me, and we got along pretty well. She kept coming over, and you know, little before we knew it, we were together. When I told my mother that my girlfriend was pregnant, she ended up kicking us out, and my father-in-law told me that, you know, if I wanted to get myself out of this situation, the main thing I had to do was, you know, get my butt to work, except that he didn't put it so nicely, you know. I felt really low, you know, and even though I felt really low, we were still hitting the pipe. We were still, you know, in our addiction, mimicking basically what I was experienced and exposed to as a child. If not even worse, though, because, you know, we were homeless. A week before my daughter was born, we were actually able to save enough money to get our own apartment. And we thought, hey, you know, we're making it. But of course, you know, the devil's a liar. You know, as much as I was trying to work as hard as I could to get where we were at, because we went from living in a tent, being homeless, to living in a garage, to taking care of somebody's property, to, you know, our one-bedroom apartment, you know, and I'm thinking, hey, we're doing such a great job, you know, but yet, you know, I still allowed the addiction to take over and to run our lives. We got so far in our addiction where, you know, everything just finally hit the fan. My wife was pregnant with our second child, and still in our addiction, she ended up going in labor while I was at work, and she was crying because, you know, we both knew she was dirty. I'm panicking inside. I'm trying to hold my composure, but I'm panicking because I don't want my kids taken. I worked so hard to see my family just get taken from me. And it happened. And that's really the turning point, because that's when my family was separated. My wife had to go into program. My two daughters were separated, and one was in foster care, and the other one was with my sister-in-law. And it was a struggle because we're addicts, so those desires are there. The fight inside our minds are there. But I knew that there's no turning back at this point. It's do or die. It's either you do it or you lose your family. It's either the bright light or, you know, eternal darkness. And I refuse to live in that darkness. I refuse to go back to my old ways, because the vision that I had in my mind was of my family reunited and living happily.
How does a man hold the vision of something he'd never seen before in his own child or in anyone else's? That's a miracle. Today's guest is Alina Baltazar, an experienced social worker and psychotherapist. I asked her if a child's personality can increase their risk of using drugs.
Research hasn't found a whole lot of evidence to show a certain kind of personality. There is some research that shows if they're more impulsive. So kids with ADHD, and they have that impulsivity tendency, they are more at risk because they're not thinking. They're just kind of like, oh, I'll do it without even thinking the consequences. Or if they are risk-taking personality, that's the other thing to watch for. So if you notice your kid has a tendency to get injured a lot, then, you know, you might want to watch for that. Also, kids who have emotional problems, they may turn to it to self-medicate. So not to say that's a personality, but you may see they have those tendencies to maybe be depressed, or those who have ADHD may use it to self-medicate as well to help calm them down and help them focus. So those are the types of things you might notice.
Right, and they're not necessarily aware that they are doing that.
Right.
It's just they feel that need and go for it. Now, what can parents do? Is there something parents can do to help to protect their children?
So that is my research focus and my passion as a parent of three boys myself, two of them teenagers. So what I like to tell parents is role modeling is very important. So what you do, your kids are more likely to do. And also if you talk about it, and what I like to tell parents is to say, we don't do this. So this is our family. This is what we do and what we don't. And of course, then if they're modeling it, then their kids are more likely to believe them.
Right, because you can't be saying one thing and doing another.
Right, you don't want to say, don't do what I do, just do what I say. That doesn't work.
Right.
So it's the modeling and then talking about it and having, as I said, talking about it when they're little, so then they're comfortable talking to you about it.
So how do you talk
older.
To a little toddler about it if we're saying little?
Well, and what I did with my kids is like, oh, that's yucky, it's smelly, and it can make you sick. Actually, what I like to tell my kids, if you smoke, you die. That's the message my parents gave me. It's a very simple message. And then with my kids, with alcohol makes you dumb. You do stupid things, which it lowers your impulsive. It makes you more impulsive, lowers your inhibition. So
right.
Those are the types of things I tell my kids. And then the other important thing is relationship. Having that close relationship with your kids, they're more likely to listen to you and want to model after your behavior. So attachment, modeling, communication, and then of course.
So when I'm thinking of attachment, I'm an OB, so I'm thinking attachment. As a baby in arms, is that as early
That's
as
where
it starts?
Starts? Yes, the attachment starts when they're very young, and you want to continue that. Even when your teenager starts rejecting you and you think they don't want you around, they do. It's just you have to be more indirect about it.
Okay, so as a teen, this is the most at-risk time, yet that's the time when relationships between parents and teenagers can be quite strained. So give parents who are viewing some tips about how they might do that and give us an example of, say, indirect versus direct.
Right. So as I said, I'm in the thick of this right now. And so you look for those opportunities, and there's those shared interests. There's things that you both have a passion for. My husband and 17-year-old both love baseball, and so they'll watch baseball together. So look for those opportunities that you know that you have things in common with them. My son has a girlfriend, so I'll make comments about, you know, these are things that girls like, and I compliment him on how he treats her. And both my son and I are interested in some of the same academic pursuits and interests, and so we'll talk about those things and make those observations or watch things together that we both have an interest in. So it's tricky. And there are times that they're more open. Sometimes they want some distance. And so you really have to observe and watch your child and adjust to their developmental needs.
And I guess teens can also be a little bit what we might call moody or a little more, they're more emotional, aren't they?
Right. And they're going through some difficult things, and we really need to be understanding of how difficult it is to be a teenager these days, the pressure that they're under, and to compliment them. You really want to have 5 times more compliments than criticisms of your teen, which is really hard to do. It's like sometimes you have to catch them doing good and compliment them, and they really do appreciate it, even though they don't say it, they really do.
Right, and I'm sure that's challenging. You have to just be a lot more alert when you have teens around.
Yes, you really do. It's a fun stage. I mean, you really get to have those discussions with them and enjoy them in a lot of ways that you don't with little kids.
Right. Now, you've mentioned the self-medication aspect, and that's to do with coping, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How do you teach children coping skills so that when they're out, they have the ability to say no if they really want to say no to.
So again, that starts with the babies. Teaching them to self-soothe, the importance of self-soothing, and then as they reach those toddler years when they're having their temper tantrums, teaching them how to manage life's ups and downs, to not ignore them, but then not overreact to them. And then that, as they develop and change, then you can keep teaching them new coping tools, like, you know what, I can tell that you're upset. How can you tell you're upset? And as a therapist, I actually ask kids, like, where do you feel it in your body? Do you feel a burning in your tummy, or does your head hurt? That's a sign that you need to go. Then they come up with their own coping tool. Often it's going to the room, listening to music, talking with friends. Parents can help teach them those things. It's very important. Mm. And then, again, if they have that relationship with their parents, the expectations are clear, it'll be easier for them to resist. Because parents actually have the biggest influence on their kids' behavior, even in the teenage years. Yes, peers become more important, but parents are still very influential.
Peers are important, but believe it or not, young people, parents have been with you for longer, they know you better, and they have your best interests at heart. We're taking a short break, but don't go far because Sean's standing by to take us through our paces. First, consider this. A proverb in the Bible says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Child training needs to start young, when kids are impressionable and they want to mimic everything. That's when we need to instill values and morals in them. Deuteronomy 6:4 says that God's commands will be in our hearts and we're to teach them diligently to our children. But how is that done in a world where spirituality is fading fast? If His commands are in our hearts, then they're part of us. We live them. So how do we convey them to our kids? Well, Deuteronomy 6 goes on to say we need to talk of God and His principles when we're indoors together, when we're out and about together, when we tuck the kids into bed and we rouse them in the morning. It's about building godly principles into every aspect of family life, along with having morning and evening family worship. It's about establishing a strong knowledge of who God is, and it's about demonstrating His steady love and justice in our family relationships. Does it take time and effort to teach right from wrong, to model behavior that's acceptable, and to explain the reasons why? Oh yes, and in doing it early, often and consistently, your child will know right from wrong. And God will give them the power to stand strong and true when those temptations come. We're back, and you don't want to miss today's exercise segment. So get your Swiss ball or your exercise ball out, because Sean's here.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good to see you. So as you can see, we have our stability balls. And the great way, number one, all stability balls are not created equal. Okay, so that's number one. So for sizing purposes, what you want to see is you want to be able to sit on your ball, and you want your legs to be parallel to the ground. If your hips are lower than your knees, then your ball, then the stability ball is too low, okay? Or you need to pump it up a little bit more.
Right.
Okay, so I just wanted to put that out there. So these exercises that we're gonna do today are a little bit more on the challenging side, but are focused towards this whole abdominal area, okay? A lot of people ask questions, how do I get rid of this? Yeah, it's about what you eat, but it's about the exercises. And I want you to think about ways to challenge your core, right?
Yep.
So that you can kind of trim it down a little bit.
Right.
So we're gonna warm up. Let's use the stability ball. Your arms are gonna be out front, and all I want you to do is twist to the side. Keep your eyes forward and twist. keep on going, and I'll explain something. So what you should feel are your obliques engaged, right? Go to the point where you feel the abdominal area kind of stretching a little bit. You want that stretch. Because what we're going to do today will involve those same exact muscles. And sometimes doing a warm-up that involves those muscles gets to prepare for the movement. Okay? So give me two more reps. One and two. I like that you're rotating your foot. That means you're getting a good range of motion. All right. So number one, what we're going to do is have a seat. And we're going to roll. All right. Ashley, you can do it. I think you can do it totally fine. So what I want you to do is put your hands together, clasp them together, and I want you to keep your abdominal area tight. This is called a bridge, okay?
All right.
So keep that tight. You're working the core. The core is not just the front, but it's the side and the back. I want you to rotate to that side, just allowing your shoulder, there you go, perfect, and back to the center. Get your center of your balance, and then go the other side. You could do maybe about 20 reps, you know, see how you feel. You will feel a challenge in your oblique area, okay? So keep rotating, make sure you are breathing, inhaling through your nose, exhaling through your mouth. Give me two more, one on each side, one more, perfect. And from that position, stay right there. Keep there. Now, the reason why I like to keep someone on the Swiss ball is because if you're in this bridge position and I keep you in this tense position, your core is working the entire time. So what I want you to do is put your hand here, and I want you to just walk your feet back and do almost like a sit-up. All the way up, eyes forward. Yep, now walk it back into that bridge position. Yes, and back. All the way up, eyes forward, come back. Now this can be a challenging exercise, so when you're out there, I want you to take your time. All right, three, two, one more, and up. There you go, that's not bad. All right, that's a bridge to almost like a sit-up. And then we're gonna finish off with a wood chop. Well, we're not chopping any wood, we're just gonna use the Swiss ball. So right here to the side, go to the side. And stretch. If you can see my feet, they rotate. Just to allow a good range of motion. And make sure you're breathing, okay? There's no need for you to go really hard on this, but you can do for maybe about 10 to 15 reps on each side. And it's a great way to sculpt and challenge your oblique. And everybody talks about love handles. This is how you give your love handle some love.
Yeah,
so there you go.
They won't be loving you back.
They won't be loving you back. So that's a wood chop, and I think that's a great exercise. You could use a kettlebell, you could use a dumbbell, but a great tool is a Swiss ball. It's very simple, but you can do a whole lot with the abdominal area.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's great.
And most importantly, what I would like you to do to stretch out, just kind of go here. The abdominal area may be tight. That's fine. And you're all good. That's it.
That's great. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Didn't get a workout, though.
I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I pushed you.
We let him off.
Something as delicious as a palm full of cashews or a slice of whole grain toast could reduce your risk of heart disease. The Adventist Health Study found that regularly eating nuts and whole grains carries a lower risk of coronary heart disease. This is good news. Brown rice, quinoa, and hazelnuts are all flavorful, heart-healthy foods. Nuts and whole grains could keep your ticker going for many more years. Regularly consuming nuts and whole grains is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for your questions. Jenna from Georgia asks, what's the best way to burn excess body fat for someone going through the menopause? I exercise regularly and eat healthy, but the weight is not going anywhere. Well, sorry to hear that. Age is one of the most important factors when it comes to burning energy. And it's great to hear that you're eating healthy and you're doing your exercise. It's wonderful. Now, the volume of skeletal muscle gets reduced with age and the percentage of fat tissue increases. And skeletal muscle is what determines how much we burn fat. So now it's more important than ever to maintain muscle volume by doing strength training exercises, which will include things like lifting weights, doing push-ups, sit-ups, lunges, squats, you know, the sort of things we do here on the show. Interval training is another powerful way to kick up the rate at which you burn energy, and it lasts for about 24 hours after a bout of exercise. Now, interval training is where you cycle between sort of half to 3 minutes of doing strenuous exercise and then the same of more gentle exercise. I call it going for my morning run walk. So I'll run for a certain distance or sprint and then I'll walk, catch my breath. And when I've caught my breath, my pulse is back down, I sprint again. So try that out. I find it works for me. Gloria asks, my doctor says I have high glucose. What can I do besides avoiding sweets? Well, it sounds like you might be on your way to diabetes, but you can drive this process back. There are many things you can do in addition to avoiding sweets, which of course is very important. Limiting fat consumption is also very important. Physical activity is vital. And basically, bottom line, a low-fat, plant-based, whole food diet is the best way to go. I've seen that reverse full-blown diabetes in many people. And we have a text message, is the New Wave oven healthy? Well, this is an oven that uses infrared energy and convection energy and everything all at once. So the food cooks fast. Now, the food is cooked quickly at high temperature, and this is thought to increase the amount of carcinogens that can form on the surface of the food. But basically, any baking over 120 degrees centigrade or 250 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what we'll bake a lot of things at, it does the same thing. Now, whatever you're doing, baking, grilling, whatever, it's important to avoid charring or browning your foods too much, especially when it's meat foods or carbohydrate-rich foods. So I don't think it's any worse than any of the other charring, grilling, browning type things. Thanks for those questions. Remember, you can phone, email, text or Facebook. And now let's go down to the supermarket and do some shopping. Although usually just thought of as birdseed, millet is not just to feed birds. It's been an important food staple in Asia and Africa for thousands of years, being identified in many archaeological digs. The reason for its widespread use is that it's resistant to drought and it's able to grow in semi-arid, impoverished, less fertile soil. But crop yield is best when the soil is very fertile and there's good irrigation. Millet has many different varieties, the most popular being pearl millet, which is what I have here. Other varieties include teff and sorghum, the variety determining its colour, white, grey, yellow or red. Millets are rich in B vitamins, calcium, iron, potassium, magnesium and zinc. In India, millets are milled into flour and used to make flatbread. Millet porridge is a traditional food in Russia, Germany and China. And in Russia, it's eaten sweet with milk and sugar added after cooking, or savoury with meat or vegetable stews. In China, it's eaten with beans, sweet potato or squash. In Germany, it's also eaten sweet, boiled in water with apples and honey, and they're added after cooling. I enjoy it, partly boiled, then baked with raisins, honey, milk and lemon rind. Bon appetit! Once someone is addicted to substances, it's a battle to get them off. So today we're talking with Alina Baltazar, Assistant Professor from Andrews University, about how to prevent young people from becoming involved with substances in the first place. In the previous segment, she mentioned that depression can be a trigger for using drugs to self-medicate. So here Alina explains what to watch for if depression is looming.
Well, if there's a change, and so they start being more withdrawn, spending more time in their room, spending less time with peers, their grades begin to suffer, those are things you really want to watch for. Now, sometimes it's hard to know if maybe it was there was a fight at school, or there's something that was said about them on Facebook, or their boyfriend or girlfriend broke up with them. Those types of things could happen. It doesn't mean they have clinical depression. But still, because teens are more likely to be impulsive, that doesn't mean they won't do something dangerous during those down times. Yeah. So you still want to watch for that and give them some space, but also monitor them and really let them know, hey, I'm here for you. They may not want to tell you everything that's going on with them, but just for them to know that you give them that unconditional support is very helpful. And of course, they may need professional help. They even may need medication. And that's okay to do. Get them that help if that's what they need in order to be able to get through those teen years. Remember, vast majority of teens do perfectly fine. I don't want people to get scared of those times. It's just there are these things that they're at risk for, so we do need to watch for that.
Mm. Now, self-image and self-perception can also put kids at risk of substance use. Mm-hmm. For kids that are obese, this is a real problem these days. It's because so many children are obese. Are they more at risk of using substances?
We haven't seen that per se, but I can see why maybe they'd be tempted to use something like Adderall or Ritalin, which is a stimulant, and a lot of teens are using it for their ADHD, and it's being passed around. I can see where they may be more likely to get involved in that as a way to lose weight. Mm. But I have not seen that per se as a risk factor in and of itself for substance using.
Now, coming to school education, does academic performance have an impact on substance use?
Well, in that if they feel that pressure to be near perfect to get into that the Ivy League school, that can be a risk factor for maybe Ritalin or Adderall, because kids are using it to help them stay up late or to focus on tests. That is the risk factor that we've seen. But if you're using heavy drugs, you're not going to be able to do well academically. So it's actually pursuing excellent grades is a protective factor. So kids who want to do well are less likely to get into serious drug use.
What about athletic performance, the school athletes?
There is some, especially in college, you're going to see more of the alcohol, heavy alcohol use. But because they're being tested, and again, they have to perform well, they're less likely to get into the heavy drug, except, you know, steroids is that risk. But again, they're being tested. So athletes actually have somewhat of a protective factor because of they have to perform well and they're being tested. It's just there are some things that they are more at risk for, as you said, steroids and maybe alcohol in college.
Mm. Now, should schools include drug education in their curriculum?
Yes. In fact, in our research, we find that it needs to be talked about everywhere in any opportunity that we can, with the parents from when they're little, schools throughout also their educational experience. So don't wait till junior high. It needs to be talked about throughout their experience. And again, making it developmentally appropriate. Education is a part of it, but then again, there's the relationships, there's the environment, and so religion can be also part of that environment as well, teaching those things.
Right. Now, is there a best way to convey that information? Should it be lectures? Should it be interactive? How is it best to convey this drug information?
So again, variety of ways to expose them. So yes, education is helpful, lecturing, but we've found that actually peer mentors, so older peer mentors, and it could be teachers. We really found that teachers, just having a close relationship with the teacher is very important, but also peers of their same, you know, cohort, but a few years older, can also be helpful, and giving them skills as well.
Right, because they can relate to that peer mentor. They feel that they're connected,
right,
which sometimes
right.
teens feel parents don't understand.
Right, and so having that mentor away from their parents, the older cohort, and then learning skills on how to say no are all important things that schools can teach.
And is that done sort of by play acting?
Yeah, role plays are helpful, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So all of those things. Now, when we were little, we used to take the temperance pledge sometimes. Mm-hmm. Is that still relevant? If a young child sort of makes that commitment, is that something that could impact them later?
Well, it can. They study more of the purity pledge of not having sex, and those they don't find to be all that helpful. But what I have found in my research among Seventh-day Adventist college students, those who believe God wants me to take care of my body by avoiding drugs and alcohol are 50% less likely to use alcohol regularly. So that kind of pledge, like the body is the temple and I won't hurt the body, that is a very helpful thing.
Okay, so this is coming around to the aspect of religiosity. Mm-hmm. Just before we get to that, about 40% of adolescents' time is free. They're not at school, they're not doing homework, they're not eating or sleeping. Mm-hmm. So how can we use that time effectively in this area?
Actually, the biggest risk time for teens is from 3 to 5 p.m. So basically when they get home from school, parents aren't home, that's the biggest risk factor. So if we can get them involved in community service or extracurricular activities during that time, especially if there's with adult mentors, that's an extremely powerful time to guide them towards a healthier lifestyle and making positive choices.
Wow, but often parents are at work at that time.
Right, so
got
if we can get
tips?
Them involved in other things, as I said, the after-school activities, volunteering, or just making sure that they have activities to do, even though you're not there, making them think that you're monitoring them is a helpful thing.
Sage advice. In the Bible, there's a proverb that says, "Idle hands are the devil's workshop." Don't go away, we'll be back after a short break.
We'll be right back.
And we're back. Juan's childhood was spent in a drug house, which left him addicted, dealing drugs, cutting and burning himself. Then he fell in love, started a family, and pretty soon their second child was born, prematurely. But social services got involved, sent his wife into rehab, one girl into foster care, and the baby to another family member. He had finally hit rock bottom. Now his one goal in life was to have a reunited, happy family. That's what kept him going, and here's how it turned out.
People that knew me and my addiction, they told me that as I was growing up, I would always say things, and I don't remember these things, so this is cool right here. I don't remember saying these things, but they said that I would always say that I'm gonna be the changer, the cycle breaker. Not in those words, but I was always gonna make something out of my life. That I was gonna get myself I was gonna leave and do something with my life, that I was gonna change, that when I had kids, you know, I'm gonna make sure that my kids don't go through what I had to go through. And I didn't even know I thought like that. I didn't know that it was possible, but change is possible. I know now that the reason why I went through what I went through was that powerful testimony that I walk with. I'm going on 7 years clean. And I know that if it wasn't for the grace of God, I wouldn't even be here today. By the grace of God, I have been renewed. My mind's been renewed and restored. My heart is now just full of love rather than full of anger and resentment. And it's because the love that God has for us, you know, He's been able to restore not just me, but my family. I don't take that lightly. You know, I try to work for God diligently and just seek Him in all I do. And I try to show my kids that that's what life is all about. It's not about being perfect. It's about fighting a good fight. And in fights, you lose rounds. You know, there's not such thing as just a one round fight. You know, there's many rounds in a fight. But as long as you keep fighting, just like in races, it's not just one race and you're the best racer in the world. You know, there's many races that you're going to have to race. You know, so as long as we keep racing, as long as we keep fighting, you know, we're going to come out on top. Because God's going to be pleased with what you've done, with what He's given you. You know, in the book of Philippians, it talks about His work is like ongoing. You know, and it's so awesome because I see it to this day. That no matter what I struggle in, I go to Him to it and He just comforts me and lets me know that it's all going to be okay. And that's what He did from the beginning. From the beginning, my kids were taken and everything just seemed like it was just in an uproar and that I wasn't going to make it once again. And when I went to God with it, and he gave me a vision of my children and my wife back together. And it came true. He gave me a vision of my wife and family living a sober and clean life of just nothing but just smiles on our faces. And it's true. There's not one day that goes by without us as a family just laughing together. And every time I see it, I sit back and I thank God, because I know it's His love. I know it was His plan the whole time. And it doesn't stop there. God is working all the time.
He sure is. And that's because His love is deep and true. I asked today's guest, Elena Baltazar, what role government can play in the prevention of substance abuse.
You know, they can help with those public service announcements. You know, those little things do help in against setting the culture, but also having policies against it. So not having it easily, readily available. So, you know, having the policy of not being able to buy cigarettes until you're 18 is actually a helpful thing. Some believe that the reason why marijuana use was going up there for a while is because more and more states were legalizing marijuana or for medical purposes. So again, they got that message like, oh, if it's okay for sick people, then it's okay for me.
Although now we've had a few deaths.
Right.
So you're saying that that's starting to balance and
right.
create a bit of a pushback.
So they're in as I said, edibles are making people sick, and then synthetic marijuana has been related to killing people. So that's why policies in and of itself isn't the only thing. Mm. But we have found, especially when it comes to smoking, government policies have made a huge impact. Actually, throughout the world, I did some research that policies even help in other countries on smoking. A vast majority of, there's a lot of countries that do have it, and then that's really related to lower smoking rates. So again, in the United States especially, they feel that it's not only because it's not legal until you're 18, but you know, you can't do it when you're at work, and when you're at work, you have to go out and far away from the building. It's very inconvenient to smoke, and so the parents then are less likely to smoke because of that. And then marijuana, with all the government regulations, it's still $300 an ounce to buy, and that's about a month's worth. So $300 a month is expensive for a teen and adults. And so those government policies do have an impact on use, and as I said, setting culture as well, and having more limited access is a very important role that government can play.
Right, access, I guess, for teens is teens and young adults is really important. Now, you mentioned religiosity. Mm-hmm. How does religiosity play into this whole picture of just how we treat our bodies and whether we use substances or not?
Well, going to church regularly does have a protective variable for youth and college students even. And I've found for the Seventh-day Adventist youth that I studied, going to Sabbath school is a protective factor as well, because you have to get up earlier and it's not as normalized for college students to go to Sabbath school. But also, if religions teach that we are supposed to take care of our bodies the way that God wants us to, like the body is the temple, then they're much likely to use alcohol and substances. So again, it's going to church, and then of course, what peers are you interacting with at church? So it's the peers that you have access to at church, it's then the Sabbath school and Sunday school teachers, it's the pastor, so you have mentors that are teaching positive things and they're positive role models, then the peers you're interacting with. And then there's a lot of activities at church. So it's keeping them busy, positive peer influences, positive mentors. These are all good things. Then that message of taking care of your body is important.
Right. So you're saying those of us that go to church that are older, we actually have some responsibility towards
the
mentors.
Youth. As mentors. If you're working with youth, you actually have a powerful impact in ways that you may not realize at this time. So when we ever have youth activities, we need to have a good amount of adults there. It's not just about the teens having access to each other. They need to have that a good mentors. My kids, they have a Sabbath school teacher, and he's called Big Mac, and he has a Big Mac club for early teens, and he has Facebook followers, and he's really encouraging positive interactions with him and those kids, and I, as a parent, really appreciate that, and I think it's something that, again, that us as adults going to church can really have with the kids in our churches.
That's a great example. Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't really talked about peer pressure, but peer pressure has a role, right?
Yes, it does.
And so in a church setting, you've got kids that have shared values.
Right, and so you're less likely to have that negative peer influence. You're more likely to have peer influence to not do drugs and not do alcohol. I've asked my kids about it, and they says, oh, yeah, it's not cool to do that. It's like, we don't do that. And he says, yeah, there's some that do it, but they're not in the cool group. They're on the outliers. And so the popular kids aren't using, at least in my kids' church. And then, of course, that's what we found with other religions as well, that is that way. And also encouraging that relationship with Christ. If you have that relationship, again, you don't want to disappoint him, and then if you feel that's what he's teaching you to not do those things, you're less likely to use. So it's, again, relationship, role modeling, then those relationships with the mentors are all powerful things.
So it's relations with your parents, knowing their expectations, with your mentors and knowing their expectations, and then with God and knowing his expectations.
That's right.
And when it's all a package, then it's important. And
right.
I think of my own years growing up. You know, I went into high school a year after everyone else, so I changed schools, and all of my friends were using. Mm-hmm. But I think because I had this peer group at church, I was never tempted. I watched them use, I watched them do dumb things when they were drunk or whatever. And so it was certainly protective for me.
Right. If you can find that peer group that didn't use, it's easy to resist others doing it because you're like, oh, hey, I have my friends. I don't need you.
And we tend to keep our friends at that age, at sort of teen years. We keep our friends for a long time, right?
Right. They're more likely to have more stability in the teen years. When they're younger, especially middle school, there's more instability. But as they get older, there's more stability with their peer group. And so if they have that core group, then it's easier to resist if that core group isn't using.
And can parents impact, or should they impact, who their children choose as friends?
Yes, and so they can actually, again, when they're very young, you start giving these messages like, hey, are they good for you? Are they going to get you into trouble? I've done that with my kids, and it's been very helpful. So you give those messages very early on and what to look for in a good friend. It's hard to necessarily make them change friends when they're teens, and so that's why you want to give those messages very early on what to watch for.
Alina, thank you so much for being on the show with us. It's been wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Start the conversation of drugs with your toddlers and just keep talking to them throughout their childhood. Let them know that drugs are yucky, smelly, and make you look stupid and act dumb. While none of us is perfect, strive to be the best role model you can be. Remind your kids their bodies are the temple of God, and so they need to treat that hardware with care and respect. Bond with them strongly from birth, and when the turbulent teen years strike, tiptoe around them, looking for opportunities to complement them and nurture your relationship as it moves into a new and exciting phase. By maintaining that openness, they're more likely to disclose their thoughts and emotions. Church can be a strong ally for parents with its youth groups, its strong values, and peer pressure not to use drugs. So stay involved with your local church. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you tomorrow when we ask, is marijuana safe?